17-2371 Jimenez versus DOJ. Mr. Burns, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll wait a minute.
I just wanted to make sure they could.
Yep. Give everybody a second.
Okay, thank you.
Just sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that they were still there.
Is it okay to go now?
Give him a second to sit down. Let him sit down.
It would be better for my argument if they actually aren't
here. They remain standing. All right, go ahead.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case comes to you a little bit different than most of these cases because the issue in the case goes to the hostile work environment claim that we believe the judge erred in his decision determining that a referral to OPR, the Office of Professional Responsibility, was not tainted by discriminatory or retaliatory animus. And the reason I'm not going to repeat what's in the briefs because it gets a little convoluted, but the reality of the case is this. What happened here was that Mr. Jimenez, facing a deadline, submitted what he thought in a closed system was information that supported his claim that he was being retaliated against by being given Christmas duty for a time he had already taken a vacation, and he wanted to show the court that that was further evidence of the hostile work environment he was facing, that he was suffering both denials, petty and large. There are some things that we agree about, and the reason this case comes to this posture is a little different than I think that is even pitched in the brief. The DEA has a policy that any OPR referral stops that promotion for 3 years. Now, whether that violates the merit system principles is before you. We didn't argue it below. We accepted the premise because it's important for the second issue in the hostile work environment. The agency is arguing that the two supervisors that referred my client to OPR following his submission in a closed system of evidence he believed supported his claim were unaware of the impact and didn't really discuss it in advance, even though the evidence shows that the prior limitation on his promotion to a GS-13 had been vetted through those same supervisors. So they were clearly aware that this referral would, in fact, get him limited from being promoted, which is an adverse action. The DEA wants to argue that somehow that the referral itself can't be an adverse action, but we go substance over form.
I don't understand. The administrative judge expressly found that SAC Coleman testified, and her finding was that he could not know with certainty whether a referral would lead to an investigation. They also say SAC Coleman was never asked about the portion of the John Brown memo relating to not promoting during OPR proceedings, and that Mr. McGinty expressly said he didn't have any idea.
We contest all of that.
That's all fact stuff. We review that under an incredibly deferential standard.
Certainly, but I think that the issue for the judge, the issue was, did the judge have substantial evidence to make the determination? There was testimony in the record that these two gentlemen had tried, that Mr. Coleman had tried to promote Mr. Jimenez earlier.
Well, there was evidence that they supported his promotion before, right, and even after he initiated the MSPB.
Well, he supported it before, but he was told that he couldn't promote them because there was a 3-year limitation on that promotion due to the firearm that was lost. So he certainly knew in advance that there was the Brown memorandum and this rule because he had vetted it through Herman Whaley. These were the same two people. He was told that my client could.
But the guy testified, and the AJ watched him testify and looked him in the eyeballs, and the guy said, I didn't know.
Well, but discrimination doesn't come from just.
And that's a fact finding.
It is a fact finding, but I think that the thing that ignores is that the evidence in the case was that he did know, and there were inconsistencies between his testimony and Mr. McGinty's on whether they knew the referral would impact his promotion. Mr. Coleman had physically been involved with Mr. Whaley contemporaneously before this submission because Whaley had told him with respect to the prior request to promote my client to GS-13 that there was this three-year limitation if there was a referral to OPR. So the argument that Mr. Coleman wouldn't know is belied by the fact that the underlying acceptance of the rationale for why he wasn't promoted before, because we originally challenged those promotions, the explanation from the agency that was accepted by all parties and advanced by this agency was, well, he can't promote because he's got to wait 3 years. So they knew that fact when they sent this memorandum forward. And the reason that's important is because the memorandum was sent forward.
So why do you think Mr. McGinty and Mr. Coleman would both lie? Because they both supported him for promotion beforehand, they support him for promotion afterwards. Why would these gentlemen, these supervisors, lie about whether they knew this or not?
Because the way that this came down is there were two companion cases. There was John Stark and my client, and there's even a reference to it, Israel Joseph. Stark and Jimenez were reservists who had filed an appeal. Coleman had gone into Stark's case and said, I have no animosity towards reservists because I'm promoting Mr. Jimenez. At the time, he knew he wasn't promoting Mr. Jimenez because he knew that his OPR referral would limit that promotion. In other words, he knew that by submitting this to OPR, that would limit his promotion. And we know that the gentlemen are not telling the truth, so to speak, because there are so many inconsistencies in their testimony as to how they made this referral and why they made this referral. They argued to the court, to the ALJ, they said, well, we have no discretion, so there's no retaliatory animus. We have to report this to OPR. That's not true. They had the discretion to do so, and they exercised that discretion against Mr. Jimenez. Remember,
you suggested that there might be a lie in Mr. Coleman's testimony. What about Mr. McGinty's? Because he had no idea, and he was not a participant in this other set of facts that you're discussing.
Well, Mr. McGinty was a witness in the case, and he was a witness in both Mr. McGinty and Mr. Coleman were witnesses in the USERRA appeal. The intervening event between what happened with the submission of the promotion, if you look at the timeline, there's an intervening event between when they were seeking to promote him. The intervening event is he filed the class appeal. It is at that moment that his supervisors come in and they tell him, his immediate supervisors say, you can't mention USERRA in your promotional requests. You can't mention USERRA in your submissions. And we want you to strike that. And the judge in the ALJ in this case rules that that is because that was lawyerly language that was unnecessary. In other words, the judge surmises that because I'm trying to give notice of a USERRA complaint, I'm trying to say to my supervisors, by the way, I think this thing is being held up. The thing you told me you were going to give me, I believe that's being held up because I engaged in the USERRA appeal. The distinction that the judge misses is the fundamental fact that shifted between the promotion for Mr. Jimenez and his referral to OPR was the fact that they got notice of his appeal. And when he was in the midst of that appeal, this referral, I think the court needs to focus on, here's how this happened. The allegation is not from this judge as to why the referral was appropriate is not based on the knowledge of the people. Because let us assume for the fact they didn't know. Let's assume for the fact that neither one of these individuals knew that their referral would limit my client from being promoted. To some extent, that's not particularly persuasive because the impact is more important. The agency certainly knew. And the reason that I think this is significant is that the nature of this referral was advocated in advance by the agency, accepted by the judge, because the submission of this duty roster would somehow put agents at risk. If you look at Mr. McGinty's submission to OPR, he doesn't say it's an unauthorized disclosure. He says it's a violation of national security and that my client is submitting it for personal gain. And when examined, he said the personal gain was a USERRA lawsuit. So these individuals...
What is the basis for this this bias against the military service? What is the basis for, alleged basis for that?
The basis, I think, in there's two elements to this. The basis of the underlying class complaint, if the court would like me to get into that, is that senior agents were being recalled to active duty for extended periods of time. those agents were impacting already stressed operational units, which were 20 to 30% under strength, as Mr. Coleman testified. So our position in these claims was that what was going on is that these senior agents, by doing active duty reserve service, were considered to be, quote, double dipping from the government and disloyal to the agency because they should be focused on their duties as law enforcement officers. And in those that class appeal, which I think is part of the record, that was the allegation, was that this was impairing the ability. It was imposing a liability on the agency because so many people in the Southwest and Phoenix and in San Diego and those areas were reservists because there was a natural tendency for law enforcement officers to also have been in the military. So our position on this was that the reason there was this animus is because SACs and assistant SACs were graded on their production, and this was impairing their production and their bonuses.
Are all of these facts in the record?
They should be in the underlying class appeal. They may not all be
in this particular case.
No, I don't believe that all of that is in.
So you did not rely on that in support of this case?
No, in this case is largely a retaliation case. We're saying that what happened here was that when my client filed his USERRA appeal, there was direct evidence of actual hostility from management officials. And that's clear because
Judge Mayer's question goes to where is the nexus to USERRA?
Well, my client filed the USERRA appeal. The reason the agency disciplined him in this case is because he filed a submission that they said was, quote, sensitive, that in his mind indicated disparate treatment. And so the punishment that he received, we want to focus on just the narrow issue in this case, the punishment that he received came from that submission. In other words, he made a submission within a closed system. The agency argues the reason that violated everything, and the judge accepted it, because it's important to accept why the judge...
But there was more than just the USERRA complaint. There was a violation, a technical violation, that your client released information that shouldn't have been released.
Well, the question is, first of all, there's more
than one potential issue of causality in play here.
Right, but the judge didn't find that the reason that he accepted the premise of the referral was based upon the violation. He said the reason it was significant is because the harm that could happen is the information could end up in the hands of criminals. Mm-hmm. And he did not address the issue that was clearly presented, that these officials had discretion on whether to refer that or not. So in other words, if this was a technical violation, okay, if this was, as we said it was, at worst, he submitted something he thought was helping him. He did it on his own because he faced the deadline. He did it in a way that information was either not relevant, particularly relevant, or was unnecessary. The government took the appropriate action, withdrew that. The question is, why then is there a referral to OPR? That was a discretionary
decision. Well, the supervisors felt that they were obligated.
But they weren't. That's the point that the judge didn't address, was that they were not obligated. They were not. No, they said they were mandatorily required. And the reason they said that is that would take out any question of their intent or motivation. And their intent and motivation is pretty.
But that's what they believed. Now, maybe they weren't actually required, but that's why they offered that as an explanation of why they did it.
But the reason they did it was submitted in their memorandum, which is they said he violated national security and was seeking personal gain. And the personal gain that they said he was seeking was through the filing of the USERRA appeal. And so my concern in bringing this case is that the real rationale for this referral wasn't because it was some violation per se, that there was some discretion on this. And the real reason it was forwarded was to block his promotion. In other words, they knew that the implication would be to block his promotion. It did block his promotion.
Well, the referral doesn't block his promotion. It's if the IPR takes it up.
I didn't
know whether they would take it up.
I believe, actually, anyone that's referred during the time of the referral is prohibited from being promoted. So the actual referral does block the promotion. If there's any finding, it's a three-year limitation.
I think Judge Mayer is correct on that point, but The problem that I'm having is you've got a big mountain to climb. That is the substantial evidence standard of review.
Correct. And that's why we say that when looking, well, there's a couple of things we do know. We know that the judge found two of the four Sheehan factors. He found, so we don't have to argue about that. He found that he was in a protected status and there was a proximity and a rationality to the refer, to the actions of the agency in the hostile work environment and to his military status. So that really is decided. That's not before you. The issue is the other two factors. And so when he said that he found a lack of a hostile work environment, he said he found it because he found two things. He found that that the testimony of the individuals was consistent, and therefore there were no inconsistencies. And in our brief, we pointed out there were many inconsistencies. And that's important because the issue I'm trying to get at here is in the discrimination claims, the focus is on the intentionality of decision makers doing the action. Now, the government argues about the penalty and things like that, but the cat's paw theory would kick in, and we're a little bit backwards on that. I think the thing that we're looking at, our perspective is, did the judge give a reasonable review of the evidence to support this claim that there were no inconsistencies? There was an inconsistency of whether they needed to, they were mandatorily required to refer it. There was an inconsistency in the rationale for the referral that was contained in the memorandum, which was hyperbolic in the extreme.
You've used all of your time and all of your rebuttal time. We're going to have to hear from the opposing counsel.
Certainly, Your
Honor. Mr. Mandelbaum.
May it please the court. To address the question of whether the referral itself delays a promotion, if I could direct the court to page 172 of our appendix. This is a 2002 memorandum from the Deputy Administrator John Brown III.
What page?
172, Your Honor.
And what does it say?
It says, when an employee is found to be under an active Office of Professional Responsibility investigation, active investigation includes those investigations still being investigated, being written up under consideration by the Board of Professional Conduct or deciding official, action will be held in abeyance until the completion of the process. So it has to be an active investigation, not just a referral.
And didn't one of them, either McGinty or Coleman, testify that they just because they refer something doesn't mean it automatically gets investigated and they don't know if it's going to be investigated?
Right. Mr. Coleman testified to that. That's at Appendix 2438. 2439. He testified. Well, first he was asked on 2438 at line 16, when you submitted this memorandum forward, did you know that that would limit Mr. Jimenez's ability to promote to a 13? Answer, no. And then further down at the bottom of the page, he started to explain, sometimes they send it back to me and say, no, this is a management issue for you. Or they decide to take the case. There was no, when I sent this up, there was no active investigation. I didn't know how it was going to play out. It's their decision. We've heard argument that they must have known because they were aware, they must have known that it would delay the investigation because they were aware of this three-year rule. Well, it's two different rules. One rule is, you can't be promoted within 3 years of significant misconduct. The other rule is you can't be promoted when there's an active investigation. Just because you know about the three-year rule doesn't mean you know about the other rule. They all testified that they felt that they had to refer it, at least in this instance.
Why do they feel like they had to refer it?
Mr. Coleman, this is at Appendix 2414.
It sounds like a pretty insignificant disclosure in a closed proceeding. I don't I don't understand why they felt like, did they, did, is there testimony that they felt like they had no choice but to refer it, as in the rules governing them required them to do so, or they had no choice to do it because they were uncertain of the impact of what he had done? What is their precise testimony?
That they had to do it because the rules required them to do it, Your Honor. It's not because...
Do the rules require them to refer it?
Yes, Your Honor.
What rule?
It's this is it. Appendix 582, paragraph T1. It says, reporting situations which reflect on the integrity of an employee or on DEA.
Well, I'm in 582. What section?
Top, towards the top of the page, Your Honor, section T, paragraph T, and then the one below that. It says, well, starting with T, reporting situations which reflect on the integrity of an employee or on DEA.
Okay, but then this says an employee who has an information which indicates or alleges another employee is engaged in improper or illegal activities.
Right. Will immediately report such information to his or her supervisor or directly.
What were the illegal activities he was engaged in?
Well, it's certainly improper.
Were they illegal? Is there any allegation they were illegal?
Well, I suppose I'm not sure what illegal means, if that just means it's a violation or if it means it's an actual violation of a criminal statute. But I think improper.
Well, in any event, any improper activities?
Right. So if I could direct the court to Appendix 2065. This is a document that's quoting one of the rules. It's in the middle paragraph there. It's quoting from the DEA Personnel Manual, section 2735.15.
I'm sorry, what page?
2065, Your Honor. Section 2735.15J13, it's quoting from that. In the middle there it says, no employee shall, 1, intentionally destroy, mutilate, remove, falsify, conceal, alter, or make an unauthorized copy of any government record for his or her own purposes. And then what he did was, if I could direct the court to Appendix 441.
Wait a minute. You think anybody who makes a photograph of any government record, a copy of a government record for their own purpose, any at all, must be reported through an OPR referral? Is that right? That's what you think?
According to
photocopy of any government record. There's no level of severity, and you think it's a must, not a may report. So you think any photocopy of any government record, regardless of significance, requires a reporting to OPR?
If it's unauthorized and if it's for his or her own purpose, according to the rules, yes.
Do you police the photocopy machine? I mean, you know, it just seems like a ridiculous standard. Let's go back, though, for a second to 582. Page 582, what you were talking about, says that these infractions must be reported to the proper DEA authorities. What in this section defines that as an OPR referral as opposed to just someone else within the chain at DEA?
Well,
this says you got to report it to DEA authorities. It doesn't say you have to refer it to OPR. You told me that right. This statute or this section required them to refer it to OPR.
Right.
So what portion of this document requires an OPR referral as opposed to just referring it to DEA authorities?
Right. Right below that, it says anyone who has information in violation of these standards of conduct will immediately report
to his or her immediate supervisor.
Right. Or directly to the Office of Professional Responsibility.
Right. So they had the option
right.
of referring it. They didn't have to refer it to OPR, correct?
Well, they felt that they did, Your Honor, and that's what they testified.
But they didn't. You stood up and said, yes, I asked you, Did they feel like they did, or did they actually have to report it? And you said they actually had to report it. And so we just walked through it, and now I think we've come to the conclusion, both of us, that they did not actually have to do an opioid referral.
I don't agree with that, Your
Honor. You don't agree. So you don't think an or means you have two different options?
Well, if you can Mr. McGinty, under this, could have reported it to Mr. Coleman, or he could have reported it to OPR. Mr. Coleman could have reported, he didn't, if he, I don't know if he had another supervisor, he could have reported it to his supervisor if he had one, or he could have reported it to OPR. So it goes up the chain of command, and eventually it gets to OPR if everybody in the chain of command thinks that it is actually something that meets these standards. That's if somebody looks in the chain of command, looks at it and says, no, that's not a violation, then maybe they wouldn't have to report it higher or wouldn't have to report it to OPR. But if everybody looks at it and says, I think it's a violation, it goes up the chain of command and it goes to OPR.
It sounds like you may have misspoken or perhaps overstated your argument. That you am I correct? Your position is that it has to be reported, not necessarily directly to OPR in the first instance.
Right.
It has to be reported.
It goes to the supervisor or to OPR, but when the supervisor gets it, then the supervisor makes the same decision, either report it up to my supervisor.
But in this case, the supervisor could have made the determination that, well, right, this is a minor thing. It was inadvertently disclosed, and then it was pulled back.
I think the only discretion they have is to say it's clearly not a violation.
Let's look at T2.
Right.
What does T2 say?
Right.
It can handle it if it's not a serious matter. If it's not a violation. If it's not a serious matter. This seems to me like the quintessential definition of not a serious matter. I don't think what Mr. Jimenez did, while it may technically be a violation, sounds particularly bad. The problem he has for me is that he's got to overcome a substantial evidence point of standard. And even if I think these agents did not have to refer it, and even if I think maybe they knew they didn't have to refer it, I still don't know how I get to a reversal under a substantial evidence standard.
Well, because there is substantial evidence, the court would be obligated to affirm it, Your Honor, under the standard of review.
But it seems pretty clear to me as we've walked through this personnel manual that they did not have to report it, and that a supervisor absolutely could have made a determination this is not a serious matter, because that's at least the determination I would have made under the circumstances, knowing all the facts. So then it leaves me to question what their motives were under the circumstances.
Well, certainly all of these supervisors had been advocating for Mr. Jimenez's promotion both before and after this. Mr. McGinty had been editing his memo to try to help him get promoted. And, direct the court to Appendix 207. This is an email, Mr. McGinty talking to Mr. Jimenez by email. I made many, many corrections in grammar, word choice, syntax, consistency, and sentence structure in the case write-up and accompanying position review worksheet. Your written work product needs to be perfect. He goes on to say, your written work is pretty much your only contact with me and the special agent in charge, SAC, on this matter, so it needs to reflect you in the best light possible. He's working hard on the weekends, editing his memo to try and get him promoted. But then secretly he's retaliating against him. It doesn't make sense.
What is that essay that you were talking about that he was editing?
It's the promotion memo.
So he didn't have to do that. It's not like he was editing work product that was part of in the supervisory chain, something he would have edited.
Well, I think it goes through the supervisory chain.
Did he have an obligation to edit it?
I don't think he had an obligation to edit it, Your Honor, but he...
These are actually friendly questions. You think they're hostile, so you're really suspicious and you're fighting me, but they're friendly.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again, Your Honor?
I said that these are friendly questions, not hostile questions. You're looking for the hidden, something, and they're not. They're friendly questions. So he didn't have any obligation to do this to edit this guy's memo, so he was helping him seek promotion.
Right. Yes, that's
really
right,
just, Your Honor. That's the clear evidence of record.
Right.
So that would seem to be substantial evidence upon which the AJ could have found.
Right. And the judge relied on this. And that, so that's Mr. McGinty. As for Mr. Coleman, when the promotion was delayed the first time because of the three-year rule, Mr. Coleman he's calling Mr. Whaley, who is the inspector at OPR, to advocate for the promotion. This is at Appendix 2411 and 2412. At 2411, this is Mr. Coleman testifying. You know, he said he doesn't remember every word of the conversation, but he said he called Chuck, meaning Mr. Whaley, at OPR, and said, "Hey, Chuck, got this guy. He's earned his 13. He's came back disapproved. Checking to see the status, essentially, of what the details are on this thing." And then at page 2412,
it doesn't sound like someone who's trying to thwart.
Right. At 2412, he said, so did I vehemently argue and jump up and down with Chuck? No. But I certainly said, hey, this kid is a good agent and he's done a good job. And Chuck said, I realize that, but the three-year rule for these lost guns, essentially.
That's the disciplinary proceeding for the lost gun.
Right.
That's not the disclosure of the unredacted copy of the stuff.
Right.
Yep.
So we've got
I'm trying to keep these two things separate in my head.
Right. So we've got Mr. Coleman, who previously was not only moving it through the chain of command, but advocating and maybe to a small degree complaining to Mr. Whaley when the three-year rule delayed it the first time.
And that's all the substantial evidence to support the AJ's conclusion that these two supervisors didn't have it out for Mr. Jimenez. That's not why they sent this OPR referral. They sent it because they thought they had to. Now, maybe they technically didn't have to, but even you thought they had to, so it couldn't be unreasonable for them to think they had to.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Your Honor,
right,
and I'm out of time.
Your time's up, so there you go. Let's have Mr. Burns back up. I'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Sure. Just very quickly, the actual edits are in the record. They're at Appendix 1403 on. They're hardly substantive. The other issue is I want you to look at the date. They're in April. The intervening event is he files a complaint a month later arguing USERRA. All of this stuff about how they supported him occurred before he filed his appeal. Our position is, I think you've locked on it, which is...
Did they support him after he filed the appeal?
For his 13? No, there was actually a change in the regulations where you were supposed to automatically get a promotion afterwards.
But didn't they inquire why he didn't? I mean, he didn't because of the three-year for the gun... lost gun thing,
right.
But didn't
they actually say,
why didn't he get this?
I don't believe that occurred after he filed his appeal. I think that occurred before, and they were told that he could reapply in November, and he needed to reapply it. In the intervening time, this case was litigated.
What about the fact that you were wrong when you represented to this court that the OPR referral immediately blocked a promotion?
Because the way I looked at the regulations is the OPR, while that case is referred...
Is it correct? The government's, it certainly looks to me like page 172 expressly says only an active investigation.
No, because he was already entitled, if that was the case, he was already entitled to his promotion. I mean, if the OPR referral wouldn't have blocked him, he was already entitled to his promotion before OPR actively looked into this.
Did you argue that? Maybe that would have been a good argument to make. If the rule really is that only an OPR investigation, not a referral, will block a promotion, did you argue that in this case they shouldn't have held up a promotion that he was automatically entitled to?
It's hard because the judge truncated the hearing and dealt with the OPR issues somewhat separately. Only the referral did he handle at the time. So we argued that this case should be taken as a whole. And in all candor, I'm not certain that came up in that particular context. I just want to finish with returning to, I think, the central issue is let us look at what the judge said was his rationale for finding substantial evidence. And that was that there were no internal inconsistencies in testimony. Well, there was. That there was no opportunity for them to use discretion. Well, there was. That there was no underlying motivation. And I just want to finish with, please look at the actual referral. Because you've touched on it, Your Honor. In order for them to bolster that this needed to be referred to OPR, they took what was a de minimis disclosure and they trumpeted it into a violation for personal gain and a violation of national security. And they did that knowing that they were witnesses in this case. I think given that and given that there were other attacks on him for filing the USERRA appeal, there was sufficient evidence for this ALJ to find a hostile work environment, and there was substantial evidence to suggest, or there was evidence to suggest, that his findings on their face were incorrect. None of the ones being advanced today, but the ones he advanced in his opinion. Thank you.
I thank both counsel for their arguments. The case is taken under submission.
All rise.